A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel wrote us this one, and honestly, it's the kind of letter that makes you stop and stare at the wall for a minute. He's been renting in Israel for 10 years, and he's got a file of war stories, 3 in particular. There was the landlord who refused to fix a leak for 14 months. His wife and 6-month-old son ended up in a relative's apartment. There was the landlord who ripped the toilet out of the apartment Daniel was paying rent for, right before a holiday weekend, to diagnose a leak, and then seemed genuinely confused why a bathroom full of rubble was a problem. And then there was the landlord who started renovating the apartment while Daniel was still living there and paying rent, and couldn't understand why that might be an issue.
All 3, Daniel noticed, were men over 50.
Every single one. And he's asking whether this pattern is just spectacularly bad luck, or whether it's evidence of something systemic. Specifically, he wants to know if what Israelis call the ugly Israeli, and that's a term that exists in Hebrew, by the way, he didn't invent it, is a real, researchable phenomenon with identifiable origins in a particular generation.
He's got a hypothesis. He says he sees this behavior far less in younger Israelis. He's essentially betting on generational replacement, that the problem will fade as a certain cohort ages out.
Which is either the most hopeful take on this, or the most depressing, depending on whether it's actually true. Like betting that a chronic disease will just go away on its own if you wait long enough.
Either you're right and time heals the wound, or you're wrong and you just spend a decade suffering for no reason while waiting for a cure that never arrives. So that's the question. Is this a systemic cultural product with a specific historical emergence point? Or did Daniel just have a decade of cosmically bad landlord luck?
Let's find out.
Before we chase the history, let's put a pin in what the research actually found, because it's the anchor for everything Daniel's asking. The demographic that dominates Israel's landlord class, men over 50 but below retirement age, didn't just happen to end up there. These are people who score measurably lower on 2 specific psychometric instruments, the empathy quotient, or EQ, and the reading the mind in the eyes test.
Which is the one where you look at photographs of just the eye region and identify the emotion.
And this group performs significantly below population averages on both. That's not a vibe, that's a number. And it matters because low empathy isn't just being cold or mean. It's a cognitive limitation in perspective taking, the ability to simulate what another person is experiencing. When you score low on reading the mind in the eyes, you're literally worse at inferring mental states from the most basic social cues.
When Daniel's landlord rips out a toilet and can't grasp why the tenant is upset, the failure might not be moral. It might be computational.
That's the unsettling possibility. The landlord isn't choosing to be cruel. He cannot generate the mental model of what it's like to be the person on the other side of that lease. The leak, the renovation, the 6-month-old displaced from his home, these aren't experienced as harms because the cognitive machinery for simulating another person's distress isn't firing.
It's almost like trying to explain color to someone who sees in grayscale. You can describe red until you're hoarse, but if the apparatus isn't there, the description never becomes an experience.
That's exactly the right analogy. And it's not total absence of empathy. These aren't clinical psychopaths. It's a specific deficit in the rapid automatic simulation that most people do without thinking. You see someone stub their toe and you wince. That wince is your brain running a quick and dirty simulation of their pain. For this demographic, that simulation either doesn't run or runs so weakly that it doesn't register as motivation to act.
Which brings us to the term Daniel used, the ugly Israeli. Ha, Yisraeli, ha! And he's right, this isn't some immigrant's complaint he cooked up. It's a recognized Hebrew phrase that emerged in the 1970s, and it describes exactly this pattern. The honking at 2 in the morning, the screaming at cashiers, the bulldozing through life consequences be damned. It's a cultural archetype, not a medical diagnosis.
What makes it researchable, rather than just anecdotal griping, is that it has a historical emergence point. It didn't always exist. The early Zionist pioneers, the Tzabar generation, had their own problems, but unbridled selfishness wasn't the defining stereotype. Something shifted in a specific window, and a particular cohort absorbed it.
Daniel's bet is that the same thing works in reverse. If a cultural script got written in the 70s and 80s, maybe the generation that came after didn't pick up the same script, or at least not to the same degree.
Which is a testable claim. There's a 2024 survey from the Israeli Tenants Union that gives us some numbers on this, and we'll get there. But first, we need to understand what actually happened in that window. What produced a demographic that combines property ownership with a measurable empathy deficit? Because if you don't understand how the machine got built, you can't tell whether it's really breaking down. Let's trace it. The Six-Day War in 67 reshaped Israel's psychology almost overnight. Before that, the dominant cultural model was the Tzabar, the pioneer, the kibbutznik, the ascetic who sacrificed for the collective. Then suddenly, Israel tripled its territory, and within a few years, you've got American-style consumerism flooding in, a wave of post-war triumphalism and a new cultural message. Assertiveness isn't rudeness, it's survival.
The generation that came of age in that moment, born roughly between 1940 and 1960, they absorbed that shift at exactly the point when their personalities were forming. The pioneer ethos told you to share. The post-war ethos told you to take.
And the term, the ugly Israeli, crystallized in the 70s because people inside Israeli society were watching this happen in real time and naming it. It wasn't an outsider slur. It was a self-diagnosis. The Israeli writer Amos Keenan used the phrase in a 1971 column, and it stuck because it describes something people recognized everywhere. The guy who cuts in line, the driver who treats traffic lights as decorative, the landlord who treats tenants as obstacles to profit.
That's the cultural script. But scripts need stages. And the stage for this particular script was the 1980s housing boom.
This is where the mechanism locks into place. In the early 80s, Israel underwent rapid privatization of public housing. Rent control protections that had existed since the 1950s were dismantled. Suddenly, owning property wasn't just having a place to live. It was a vehicle for wealth accumulation. And the men who were then in their late 20s to early 40s, exactly that same post-war cohort, were perfectly positioned to buy in.
They had the income, they had the timing, and they had the cultural permission structure that said maximizing your own advantage was the smart play, not the shameful one.
You get this concentration. A specific demographic, shaped by a specific cultural moment, flooding into property ownership during a specific economic window. And then the empathy deficit becomes operational.
Walk me through how that actually works in the cases Daniel described. The leak refusal first.
I think of it as inconvenience blindness. The landlord hears there's a leak. He knows, abstractly, that water is coming through a ceiling. But the reading the mind and the eyes research tells us he's bad at inferring lived experience from partial information. So he cannot simulate what 14 months of that leak actually means. The mold smell that never leaves. The bucket you empty three times a day, the six-month-old whose room is uninhabitable. His cognitive model stops at water, ceiling. Eventually, I'll get to it.
The toilet removal?
That's dignity blindness. The landlord sees a plumbing problem that requires access. He removes the toilet. In his mental model, that's step one of a repair. What he cannot generate is the experience of being a paying adult who now has to use a bucket in an apartment full of rubble over a holiday weekend. The humiliation, the absurdity, those are mental states he doesn't simulate.
The renovation, while Daniel's still living there?
The landlord owns the apartment, so in his cognitive framework, it's his space that someone is temporarily occupying. The idea that the tenant has purchased a right to quiet enjoyment, that it's Daniel's home, not just the landlord's asset, doesn't compute. Workers in the kitchen while you're paying rent? To him, that's just efficient scheduling. To the tenant, it's a violation of the basic premise of the transaction.
All three cases are failures of the same underlying mechanism. Not malice, but a missing simulation engine.
That's what makes the psychometric data so powerful. These aren't just stories. The empathy quotient measures exactly this, the capacity to identify what another person might be feeling and respond appropriately. The reading the mind in the eyes test measures the more granular ability to read emotional states from minimal cues. This demographic scores low on both. It's measurable, it's reproducible, and it maps directly onto the behaviors Daniel described.
Which means the ugly Israeli isn't a character flaw in a few bad apples. It's the predictable output of a specific historical assembly line. Take a generation shaped by post-war individualism. Give them economic opportunity during a housing privatization wave, and you get a landlord class whose cognitive profile makes them systematically blind to tenant suffering.
The blindness is self-reinforcing. If you can't simulate the tenant's distress, you never get the feedback that would correct your behavior. The tenant complains, but the complaint doesn't land as a legitimate grievance. It lands as noise, as unreasonable demands, as someone being difficult. The empathy deficit doesn't just cause the initial behavior. It prevents the learning that would fix it.
It's a loop. The deficit causes the behavior, and the deficit also blocks the correction mechanism. You can't learn from feedback. You can't process.
It's a closed circuit. And that's why these landlords often seem confused when tenants finally explode in frustration. From their perspective, the tenant went from 0 to 100 for no reason. They missed all the intermediate steps because those steps were communicated through emotional signals they couldn't read.
Which probably makes them feel like the victim in this situation. I'm just trying to manage a property, and this crazy person is screaming at me.
Now you've got a landlord who not only fails to fix the problem, but also feels morally justified in not fixing it, because the tenant has proven themselves to be unreasonable. The loop tightens. The damage doesn't stop at the individual landlord. This is where the knock-on effect get grim. When enough tenants have experiences like Daniel's, the entire market adapts to expect abuse.
The normalization of dehumanization. You stop pushing back, because pushing back has never worked. You accept the leak for 14 months because the alternative, fighting a landlord who can't simulate your distress, is exhausting and usually futile.
That becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Landlords act badly because they can. Tenants stop complaining because complaining achieves nothing. The system reaches equilibrium at a very low point. And new tenants enter the market already primed to accept conditions that would be unthinkable in, say, Germany or the Netherlands.
I'm thinking about the psychological toll of that normalization. If you spend a decade learning that your distress doesn't register with the people who have power over your living situation, that's not just a housing problem. That starts to reshape how you see yourself, your sense of whether your needs matter.
Learned helplessness in the most literal sense. And it spills over. The tenant who's been trained not to complain about a missing toilet is probably less likely to advocate for themselves in other domains too, at work, in medical settings, in civic life. The landlord-tenant relationship becomes a kind of training ground for diminished agency.
Which brings us to Daniel's optimism, the generational replacement bet. He says he sees far less of this behavior in younger Israelis. Is he right?
The 2024 Israeli Tenants Union survey gives us the clearest picture. 68% of complaints against landlords over 50 were unresolved after 12 months. For landlords under 40, that number drops to 41%.
Younger landlords are measurably more responsive. That's real.
It is real. But look at that 41%. That's still nearly half of all complaints going unresolved. The sample size is smaller because property ownership skews older, but the signal is there. Younger landlords are better, but they're not good.
Which suggests the problem isn't purely generational. There's something structural underneath.
The system itself incentivizes neglect. Rent control is weak to non-existent. Tenant protections exist on paper, but enforcement is a ghost. The small claims court process is so slow that by the time you get a hearing, you've already moved out, lost your deposit, and developed a stress-related condition.
The ugly Israeli may fade as a cultural type, but the ugly system remains, and systems have a way of shaping the people who operate inside them.
That's the uncomfortable pivot. A 28-year-old who inherits a rental property from his father might start with better empathy scores and genuine good intentions. But 3 years into managing tenants in a system with no meaningful accountability, what happens? The incentives haven't changed. The enforcement hasn't changed. The power imbalance is identical.
You can almost hear the rationalization forming. I'm not like those old slumlords. I'm just being practical.
There's a cross-cultural parallel here that's instructive. The United States shows a similar correlation between older male landlords and lower empathy scores. But the cultural permission structure is different. In the U.S., bad landlord behavior gets called out through digital reputation systems. Yelp, tenant forums, social media shaming, The Karen phenomenon, which is another demographic-specific antisocial pattern, is being slowly eroded by exactly this kind of accountability infrastructure.
The Karen emerge from specific historical conditions, suburbanization, economic anxiety, entitlement scripts, and it's being unwound by the simple fact that everyone has a camera now. Accountability changes behavior.
In Israel, the ugly Israeli label itself creates a permissive environment. When bad behavior is expected, it's tolerated. The cultural script says this is just how landlords are. The label that was supposed to shame the behavior ended up normalizing it.
It became a category instead of a critique. He's just an ugly Israeli. As if that explains rather than condemns.
That's the structural trap in its purest form. Even if generational replacement shifts the empathy baseline upward, the system is designed to erode whatever gains that shift produces. The 41% unresolved rate for younger landlords isn't a ceiling. It might be a floor, and the direction of travel could easily be upward as those landlords age into the same incentive structure their parents operated in.
Where does that leave someone like Daniel, who's stuck in the middle of this right now? What can you actually do?
Three things, and they work at different levels. First, for tenants, document everything. Every WhatsApp message, every ignored repair request, every photo of mold or missing toilets. But documentation alone is useless if it sits in a folder. The leverage comes from digital reputation systems, Facebook tenant groups, review sites, community forums. The 2024 survey data shows younger landlords are more responsive to reputation pressure. They grew up in a world where bad behavior leaves a searchable trail. The ugly Israeli is less ugly when there's a public record.
Sunlight is disinfectant. The older landlords might not care, but the market cares, and eventually the market makes them care.
Second, and this is for policymakers, mandate perspective, taking exercises as part of any landlord licensing or registration system. The research on this is encouraging. Even brief interventions, like writing a short narrative about a day in the life of a tenant, temporarily boost scores on the reading the mind and the eyes test. It's not permanent, but it doesn't need to be. You just need the landlord to simulate the tenant's experience once before making a decision about that leak or that renovation.
You're not trying to turn them into empaths. You're just trying to boot up the simulation engine for 30 seconds.
And the third insight is for everyone listening who's not a tenant or a policymaker, but just lives in this society. Recognize what the ugly Israeli actually is. Not an immutable national character, not a curse on the land, but the product of specific historical conditions. The 70s cultural shift, the 80s housing boom, the weak tenant protections. Those conditions were built, which means they can be unwound. Daniel's replacement theory has real merit. The empathy numbers are moving in the right direction, but only if structural change follows.
The generation ages out, but the system has to age out with them. Otherwise, you just get nicer people doing the same things.
The 41% tells us that's exactly the risk. Nicer people, same unresolved complaints, different rationalizations. Here's the open question Daniel's letter leaves us with. Will the next generation of landlords actually be better, or will the system corrupt them too?
The 41% is the warning sign. It's better than 68, sure, but it's still nearly half of all complaints going nowhere. That's not a solved problem. That's a problem with the younger face.
Systems reproduce themselves. A 30-year-old landlord in 2040 who inherited a portfolio from an empathy-deficient father. Maybe he starts with better intentions, but the incentives haven't budged. Weak enforcement, slow courts, tenants who've already learned not to push back. The machine is still the machine.
Daniel's counting on replacement theory, and I get why. There's something viscerally satisfying about the idea that a whole generation of unpleasant people will simply age out and take their behavior with them. But the 41% says the behavior doesn't disappear. It just gets diluted.
The ugly Israeli isn't a curse on the land. That's the thing I want people to take from this. It's a specific, researchable, and potentially reversible cultural pattern. We know when it emerged, the 1970s cultural pivot. We know what locked it into the housing market, the 1980s privatization wave. And we know the mechanism, a measurable empathy deficit that makes landlords systematically blind to tenant suffering.
Understanding those origins is the first step to designing the pattern out. If you built it, you can unbuild it.
which is where we want to leave this. Daniel asked whether the ugly Israeli is real and whether replacement will fix it. The answer is yes, it's real, and replacement helps but isn't enough. What we need now is data on what actually works. So, if you've had a landlord experience, good or bad, share it. But share what worked too. The reputation system that got a repair done, the approach that actually made a landlord respond, the policy that made a difference. We don't just need more war stories. We need a playbook.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1892, a ship carrying the Eaton Fives team to a match in the Falklands nearly capsized in the Drake Passage. The crew credited their survival to the team's practice balls, which they used to plug a breached porthole during 70-knot winds.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us your own landlord stories, or better yet, what actually worked, email the show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.